Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a Flagstaff guitar maker on the literal and figurative resonance of raw wood. And, in just a moment, why the Trump administration's latest round of cuts threatens election security. But first, with Major League Baseball spring training in full swing, writer and performer Brett Moore is bringing Batter Up, his solo show about baseball, to Scottsdale Performing Arts Center tonight. The show is a kind of hybrid storytelling and game show. Moore weaves personal and historical narratives about baseball together with live onstage trivia, where audience members try to stump him by quizzing him at random about various baseball facts. For example, they'll call out a year, and Moore will reply with the two teams who played in that year's World Series, who won, in how many games, and a few interesting facts about key players. As a baseball fan, I was totally delighted by this concept for the show, and Brett Moore joins me now to talk more about it. Brett, my first question would be, when it comes to these spontaneous trivia questions, do you have to study up on, the entirety of baseball history before each run of the show, or do you find that this is just information you've organically absorbed as a fan and can summon on a whim?
It's mostly in there now. There's a lot of this stuff that I told a joke in one show that now that I know this stuff, I just can't unknow it. It's just there. It's all here.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons I'm so fascinated by your show. Because something that comes up for me all the time is, you know, my favorite team is the Baltimore Orioles. And it's a great franchise. And would really love to see one more starting pitcher signing this offseason. But that's not what we're here to talk about.
Exactly. Everybody can always use one more.
Yes, yes. Although you're a Dodgers fan, if I'm not mistaken.
You are not mistaken. And yeah, we have a slight surplus.
You got them coming out your ears, man.
We really do.
But like this thing will happen where, you know, just as an example, the Orioles will call up some new prospect to make their major league debut, and it'll be announced that they're going to wear uniform number 6. And my first thought will be like, woo, nobody's worn that since Melvin Mora. And then I have this thought like, why do I know that?
That's exactly how I feel. And a lot of this kind of came out of that, wait, why do I know that? How do you know that? I don't know. I just know it. And what's really cool about baseball fans specifically is diehard baseball fans all have something like that. They just go, wait, why do I remember that? Like, oh man, the first player I remember seeing wear number 3 was Chad Fonville for the Dodgers, who was a utility infielder back in the 90s. So it's stuff like that that just sticks.
I feel like something else that is appealing about this conceit for your show is that in my experience, and I'm sure you feel this way too, when you have that moment where you realize you remember something, it's intensely satisfying. It's like, it's not just, why do I know that? I like that information lives in me, or that history is alive in me.
That is a great way of thinking of it. And I think that is what provides us that charge. Oh, cool. I remembered something really unique. Mm-hmm. And it brings back, I think, in addition to that history being alive in you, is it takes you back to the moment.
Yes.
And there's a unique connection with the moment in mm-hmm. baseball and with baseball fans. One specific defensive play that doesn't end up meaning a whole lot in the course of a game, but sticks with you because you saw it.
Yes, exactly. It's not like knowing the capital of Vermont because you learned that in social studies. You know, it's like your body wanted to hold that information.
You know, sports at their best offer a powerful emotional connection. Either, you know, sometimes in elation, sometimes in the agony of defeat. But yeah, the other thing that they really provide is through that emotional connection, you get to grow a community. And you get to share in that community with other fans. And one of the great things about doing this show has been I have not yet had a performance where there weren't some fan waiting at the end of it going, oh my gosh, you talked about how much you love Vin Scully. Here's a message he left for my husband when he fell ill with cancer. Vin Scully personally called and left him a message because he was also in the radio community, I believe also at NPR in Los Angeles.
Wow. I mean, tell me if you agree with this, but I feel like another reason that stories like this feel so powerful to baseball fans is that there's so much baseball, not just over the course of history, but in a given season or even on a given day, there's just a ton of baseball happening. So there's just so many different touch points. So it becomes so stitched into your life routine, and it makes it a little bit easier, I think, than in other sports to imagine yourself being part of that world. So that then when you get some little pinprick interaction like the ones we've been talking about, it's intensely gratifying. It's like a little dream coming true.
I absolutely agree. It is every day. And I've learned such important lessons just from that fact. Like, literally, you could go out there tomorrow, you could strike out four times and make three errors, and the next day you might go 5 for 5 and drive in the winning run. You have no idea what each day is going to bring, and baseball so uniquely illustrates that.
100%. I mean, I think about it, like it becomes the context that I apply to challenges I'm trying to figure out. Like, case in point, you know, in a given week, generally here on the show, I'll have 5 pieces on the air. Sometimes that number varies, but usually it's 5. And I'm always telling myself, all right, I got to hit 5 home runs, you know?
Yeah.
But the reality is, if you go 2 for 5, obviously you're putting your all into every at-bat, but let's say you only really make solid contact 2 out of 5 times. If you do that over the course of a full season, you're hitting 400, you're a Hall of Famer. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. It's a game that, more than any other sport, I think baseball is a game predicated on failure and how you handle it.
Yeah. So give us a sense of what's the flavor of the stories that you tell in between the gamier sections of the show.
One of my favorite things to talk about is that my grandmother was a huge Cubs fan, and maybe the most optimistic Cubs fan in the world in the 90s, because she really thought they were in it. But I also, you know, I was so excited this run to include a lot of information about the Negro Leagues, going back to 2020 when Major League Baseball recognized Negro League records from 1920 to 1948 as now being Major League records. And it's something that I really wanted to use the most recent run partially as an educational tool for the Negro Leagues a little bit. There's so much, and there are so many arguments that people make both for and against their inclusion. And sometimes we just need a little more context, and there's things that people don't necessarily know or realize.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, there is the racial element to it also, where it's forcing you to have a conversation with yourself about the discriminatory history of this sport that means so much to you. And it's of a piece with what you were talking about the frequency of failure, is that baseball, in these little ways and in these big ways, like, if you love baseball, you love a sport that was exclusionary towards Black people for decades and decades. Baseball brings you into contact with the reality of who we are as a people, for better and for worse.
It absolutely does. I studied history and archaeology when I was in college, and our culture reflects baseball much as baseball reflects our culture. And so there are two sides to that, and that you do have to reckon that this was a thing that was standard in the United States at the time. And baseball participated in it, but baseball was also among the first public places in American life to start to strike down those barriers.
Brett, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you so much for making the time.
The Whiz Kids had won it. Bobby Thompson had done it. And Yogi read the comics all the while.
Brett Moore will be performing Batter Up tonight through Sunday at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts.
We're talking baseball. Klazuski, Campanella, talking baseball. The man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber and the nuke.
The Trump administration continues its wide-ranging and drastic cuts on services provided by the federal government. In one of their latest moves, the Department of Homeland Security recently announced the termination of a program that helped state officials monitor potential election interference. The program, which was called the Election Interference Information Sharing and Analysis Center, or ISAC, had been established in 2018 in the wake of Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election. But per a March 3rd email obtained by Jen Fifield at VoteBeat, that program no longer supports department priorities. That is a direct quote from the email. Jen joins us now to explain the implications of all this. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for being here to talk about this. Can you give us sort of a concrete sense of the kind of information that this ISAC program would have provided to a state election official?
Sure, absolutely. If you remember, there were a bunch of hoax bomb threats that happened during this November election. That's a great example. The reason why states were able to continue running their election without fear is because they had been alerted through the system that these were hoaxes. Of course, everyone is looking out for alerts across many different systems, but this was the main way that states saw what was happening in other states, cybersecurity-wise and physical security-wise during elections.
Got it. So obviously, states themselves are able to monitor some of this, but this service was designed to identify threats that might have crossed state lines and help separate fact from fiction, it seems. The Trump administration, as I understand it, is making a sort of freedom of speech argument to justify cutting this program, though. Can you explain that?
Well, part of the program that was criticized was run by the Center for Internet Security, where they monitored misinformation or misinformation about elections. But they had phased out of that a while ago. There had been a lot of criticism that it was censoring free speech by monitoring social media, the government requesting for the social media companies to look at certain posts. That they phased out of that. Now, the services that were directly cut and targeted by the Trump administration were more than ones that we talked about, the monitoring of cybersecurity and physical threats. And like you said, it wasn't explained on why, other than saying it wasn't a priority.
Well, let's talk about the local impact of this. In your piece, you write that Secretary of State Adrian Fontes offered the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency a tour of state election offices, presumably to demonstrate the value of the ISAC program. What happened?
So this was actually through the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, which is known as CISA. They do assessments of physical spaces and cyberspaces for local governments. They've done this for years. Now, Fontes was just doing these tours in the off-election year and had scheduled for CISA officials to come with because of their expertise. Now, about a month ago, they said they were not able to make it up to two Northern Arizona counties on these tours. Since then, we've had 8 of these tours and they haven't been present.
I see. So where do these cuts leave election security infrastructure in Arizona and states like Arizona that have large rural populations?
I think it's still too soon to tell. I know the Pennsylvania Secretary of State was concerned specifically was for the smaller and rural counties there. They just rely a little bit more on the federal government to help them with things like, their physical, even, cybersecurity assessments of their systems. So there are a lot of state election directors concerned right now. They've already written to DHS. They're just waiting to see what services this nonprofit Center for Internet Security can still provide even with the funding cuts.
Yes, that does seem like a critical point here, that though the ISAC program was cut, there may still be other federal resources available.
Not really federal government resources, but this nonprofit that was kind of running the show for CISA, for the federal government for a while, might be able to still pick up on this. But we don't know. Their funding was just cut, and so we're waiting to hear a little more. I think it's causing uncertainty. Luckily, most states don't have a statewide election this year. So we're just kind of in this holding period right now.
All right. Well, we'll definitely be monitoring the situation and hope to talk to you more about it as we learn more. Jen Fifield is a senior reporter for VoteBeat. Thank you, as always, Jen.
Thank you.
Good. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, one person's journey from playing guitars to building them.
Our entire perception of time is based on this rhythm that our planet experiences as it rotates around the sun. You know, I have a pretty deep thing with music and what it means to be on Earth and as a human and the way we experience time.
We'll hear from a Flagstaff guitar maker as our analog series continues. But first, speaking of making things, it is time for the next installment in our series about Arizona makers called Made in Arizona with my co-host, Mark Brody.
I could take risk with embroidery in a way that I couldn't take risks in other areas of art.
A lot of my paintings, gravity doesn't matter a whole lot.
Dance wasn't something that is necessarily seen in galleries, you know? And I just remember being like, this is the key. This is how dance gets out there.
I try to tug at people's heartstrings. I try to do something disturbing.
I escaped real life and I went back in time.
And today we're heading to Santan Valley in a large warehouse-looking building filled with machines old and new. This is the home of Lifetime Leather Company. Inside, workers make everything from bags to wallets to belts to all kinds of other leather goods. Ty Bowman is the company's founder and showed me around the workshop. Among tables filled with tools and large pieces of leather, he stopped to point out one spot in particular.
And in our origin story, this is the original desk. The first desk that we got, where we made actually everything by hand from scratch. This is where we do all of our cutting. And over the years, we've kind of evolutionized from cutting with scissors to having that little roller cutter to eventually going to hydraulic press cutting. And then we went to laser, and then we eventually came to this machine, which helps us cut a lot of stuff.
The space is filled with both full rolls of leather as well as smaller pieces that have been cut and are waiting to be turned into something. Bowman says leather cutting is a lot like puzzle work in the sense that you have to figure out how to fit the most pieces into the material you have. And that origin story he mentioned, it involves a zip lining accident when Bowman was a teenager more than two decades ago. It left him unsure if he'd ever walk again and needing ways to pass the time. Among other crafts, he picked up leather, which he'd learned about earlier in his life, and he just kind of didn't stop, even after he recovered and was, in fact, able to walk.
I learned from the Boy Scouts. So, well, it's kind of a mixture. In our origin story, we have, like, how that injury set me up where I was in bed a lot. I did calligraphy and leather work, but I did leather work because I had done the leatherworking merit badge, and I was pretty good at it. And I enjoyed it. So I started leather work when I was 13 and making bags and pouches and stuff. And then working through it, reading books, because there wasn't YouTube or anything back then. So I had a lot of leather books and would learn from that. So it's kind of traditional style. And then once we started, like in 2014, 15, YouTube really became pretty valuable.
I would think, though, that in the end, this strikes me as something you need to do in order to get better at. Like, you can read all the books and watch all the videos you want, but you actually have to do it.
Yeah, trial and error is king. Fail and fail fast. And two, leather's honestly, like, so forgiving. It's a really forgiving medium. To a degree, if you make a mistake, it's like, huh, it won't work for that shape anymore. But you could make something smaller.
So you mentioned that after your accident, you were in bed for a while, you sort of went back to something that you had done when you were younger. Did that in any way, sort of your growing interest in leather work, did that help in your recovery at all? Did it help you sort of get back up on your feet?
Yeah, it definitely helps a lot. When I did get hurt, they almost amputated my leg, and they told me that my chances of walking again would be like next to zero. So that was really discouraging, but anything that you could do to take your mind off it was helpful, and crafting was always really fun.
I want to take you back to when you're in bed, start, you know, getting back into leather. Like, how did you go from that to all of this?
So it started out slow. So when I was recovering, that was when I was 15 years old when I got in that accident. And it wasn't until I was about 22 years old when I started really pushing the leather. I was working at Home Depot at the time, and because I did do construction before that, but with the way the economy was, the bottom fell out in construction and there was no work. And I was actually living in a little one-bedroom apartment with my wife, and Christmas was coming and we had no money. I didn't really know what I was going to do. And my wife's grandfather, who had passed, willed me a box of leather tools. I have them over at that desk. But with those leather tools that I had, I was just like driving, and I'm like, what am I going to do for Christmas? And then it kind of just like hit me, and I was like, oh, you know what? I could make stuff. You know, I know how to make stuff. And there was this lady who had a couch on the side of the road, and I asked her if I could have it, and she said, yeah. And I cut the leather off of that couch, and from that couch started making leather goods. You know, I made bags, wallets, like a phone case, and a bunch of stuff. I made like 20-something items for all my friends and family. And it was a huge hit. Everybody really, really liked it. And I started getting requests, can you make this, can you make that? And then I was working for part-time at Home Depot, and I had like a pager, scanner phone, and I had like scissors and an apron, and I would make these little gadget holders, and people were like, wow, that's really cool. Like, where'd you get that? I was like, oh, I made it. And they're like, oh, could you make this? Could you make that? And I was making more money selling leather goods at Home Depot than I was working at Home Depot.
So you like had a side hustle going on inside Home Depot?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like I made like that entire Home Depot. I made them all scanner cases, and it was wild, but it was really fun. And then I eventually got to the point where it's like, I would make more money doing this at home than working at Home Depot. And it was a huge risk, and we did it. And at the time my wife was going to nursing school, and that was the first, within the first 6 months of Lifetime Leather. And it was really starting to take off. And we were like, we just had to sit down and be like, I think that if we both work together on this one goal, that we would do better than if you went to nursing school. And it was like the Vikings burning their ships. It was literally, we called and she gave up her spot in the nursing, which she'd waited 3 years for and already had done all the prereqs for. So when she did that, it was like, it's for reals now. And after that, it had to work.
One of the things that we hear a lot when we talk to people who are good at making things is that there's so much more to the business that they find out sort of as they go, like the business side of it, the marketing side of it. I'm wondering how that's been for you.
Yeah, definitely. I think if most people realize how much goes into business, they would quit before they start. I think the secret for me is that I was dumb enough to think I could do it. Because there's so much that you have to do that you're not prepared for that if you knew about, you'd probably quit.
What do you think your teenage self who was stuck in bed in a wheelchair, you know, going back to the Cub Scout merit badge, would think and say if he could see what you have here?
When I was hurt, I wanted to give up because I was being told, I was like, you know what, you'll probably never walk again. I got like a brochure for like things you could do in a wheelchair, you know? And I remember being like, this is bad. At the time when I was 15, I was actually training every day to be a tennis player. And the US Open was playing while I was in the hospital, and I was just super depressed. But my dad was really, really into like the power of positive thinking and like motivational stuff. So he just like was able to talk to me and be like, hey, you know what? Like the power of your thoughts can shape your entire life. So if you think you're done, you're done. But it's like whatever you think about most of the time, it will happen. So using goal setting and all that, making lists, I was able to plan out what I wanted my future life to look like and how I planned out my life from then is very close to what my life is right now. I'd say almost identical. Like that accident that I had with my legs, I heard nothing for a year. I'm just so sorry, I'm so sorry. But now that I look back at it, much. That was the biggest blessing ever.
That was Ty Bowman, founder of Lifetime Leather Company in Santan Valley.
Good morning. Welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Social media these days can feel anything but organic. Our feeds are carefully curated, not by us, but by sophisticated algorithms that somehow know that you're a fan of Taylor Swift, and you have a dog that likes squeaky toys, and you're worried about climate change. They know us better than we know ourselves. But our next guest this morning says there is one place left on the internet that is still pure, or at least more pure, and hints at the utopian free exchange of ideas that the internet's original founders were looking for. Amanda Kerberg is a PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication, where she studies digital culture. And my co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about this.
I remember when social media was actually about your social life, right? Like it was about posting pictures of who you went to the bars with and the meals you ate, and like everything was chronological.
Yes. Yeah.
You remember this? Talk about that.
Absolutely. And there was no curation. Like you would go out one evening and you would post 87 pictures the next day. 100%. This was before we all had to learn to become event photographers just to live our own lives.
And it was about who you're friends with and what they're doing.
Yeah, it was so focused on, like, we talked a lot about the divide between the online life and the in-person life.
Yeah.
Because so much of our online life, initially we'd gone through this sort of era of anonymity, but when social media started, it really became about taking our offline life into an online representation of it.
Yes.
And really using that to show kind of what our real lives looked like.
Yeah. So I'm sure some of that had to do with the fact that we were young and in college.
Absolutely.
But social media has fundamentally changed since then, too, even for kids who are in college now. And today, the companies and the people who are running social media sites, and maybe just the political environment in general, have made social media a much more political and polarized place, like much of society.
Yeah, absolutely. Originally, these algorithmic feeds were very much designed around your ego network. And what we see now is that it ended up shifting to really what TikTok came about and did this so incredibly well is a taste algorithm, so that it's less about who you're connected to and who they know, and more about how your tastes reflect kind of what kind of person you are, which is why everybody then gets on TikTok during the pandemic and starts to go, how do they know that I have like 2B curly hair and that, you know, I'm an environmental activist? Like, because TikTok would look at the kinds of videos that you're watching and go like, oh, this person likes cross stitching. This person probably also likes frogs. And you'd be like, I mean, I do like frogs. How did you know that?
It's they know you better than you do.
Absolutely. But the thing about both types is that both of them are putting you into silos without even your knowledge or your active curation. And that means that not only are you seeing people you know who think like you and tastes that make sense for someone who thinks like you, you're just getting more and more ensconced in these algorithmic bubbles, which, of course, we've seen is one of the reasons Blue Sky has started to take off, is that people are pushing back on that.
Right. But Blue Sky is also a good example of polarization in a way, right? Because we saw Elon Musk buy Twitter, and lots of people on the left end of the political spectrum say, I'm not going to be on this site. I'm going to be on Blue Sky. So it's self-selecting, but you're also saying that it's way more than that. Like, this has been selected for you in many ways.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's how Facebook found out that, say, what prompts engagement is outrage. Research has actually shown that essentially what most prompts us to, like, get involved, talk back, press some buttons is what they call big if true. The problem with that is the if true part.
Okay, so you are here to make an argument for one particular social media platform
that you think
maybe hasn't fallen to this kind of this trope, which is Reddit.
Yes.
And I'm not an avid Reddit user, but you're going to show me a little bit about what this looks like and how it works. And it's pretty old school, right? That's the idea.
Yes, it's very old school. It is so lively and vibrant and silly and serious at the same time. It has its own cultural norms that can really kind of upset traditional structures. I mean, think of like Woody Harrelson coming on to do an Ask Me Anything and not understanding that the vibe was very serious about anything. He just keeps trying to go like, let's take it back to Rampart, which was the movie he was promoting at the time. And this has become a meme on Reddit of like, can we get this conversation back to Rampart? Because the idea that you can interact on a platform like Reddit in these kind of traditional authority controlled information type ways is nonsense. And so I think Reddit really speaks to the idea of this kind of culture of free exchange of info that we get from both the hacker culture and the kind of hippie hippie culture.
And it hasn't lost this today?
I don't think it has. Has it dissipated? I would say absolutely yes. But it gives you the opportunity to not just curate, you know, they call it the front page of the internet, which was, I think, a wonderful play on the idea that everyone everywhere all at once is upvoting or downvoting content to create the front page, which is a sort of beautiful metaphor for this kind of upset to gatekeeping. I think Reddit has so much potential to make space for that in a way that's really, really beautiful, but also includes, you know, cats and at every turn and silliness and just, yeah.
But it gets back to that almost utopian idea, right?
Yeah.
That the original founders of the internet had. I wonder what you think about the broader question this all brings up, right? Like, what do we want out of our social media platforms? Like, what are we trying to get?
Oh, that is such a complicated question, because I think one of the reasons that Reddit still has so much value is that they kept the anonymity that none of our other social media platforms have. Mm. And I think that there's so much to be said about the way that kind of celebrity culture has really influenced the way that we interact on social media, that we've all sort of become these mini micro celebrities in the sense of the way that we are curating our own images and our own brands. And I think that Reddit's ability to allow us to deliberate partly does function on the fact that we're not so focused on being our own tiny versions of celebrities there. And I think there's value to that. I think there's value to making a joke that a lot of people upvote in that moment, but that is kind of ephemeral, that it's not important that you're going to get more followers just because you made a great joke
or
that
you're
building your brand.
Yeah.
But that said, I am really interested in what Blue Sky is doing. But Blue Sky is proposing a marketplace of algorithms.
Okay.
So there are still algorithms, but there are choices you're making about how they'll structure the information that you get. I think that's a really interesting idea. If you think back to, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, Milton Mill, and this marketplace of ideas, and the idea that like we have these spaces like the Greek Agora where everybody's sort of like shouting ideas and when these ideas all clash together, truth emerges.
Yeah.
I think we've lost our belief in that, particularly as, you know, before those ideas have a chance to clash, the algorithm is curating your access to just one of them over the other.
Yeah.
So I think that if there is a way to sort of choose some golden mean between the two extremes of this perfect sort of you only see things that make you comfortable, you only see things that confirm your existing biases, and just the information overload onslaught that none of us can really exist in comfortably, I think that would be really great.
Amanda Kerberg, PhD student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communications. She studies digital culture, as you can tell. Amanda, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. I'm Sam Dingman, and we close out today with the next installment in our Analogs series about people who make things by hand and what those things tell us about those people.
We figure it's about 80, 90 years old.
Even though the technology is so rudimentary, you can have a lot more control.
It has lately, in the last 15 years, turned into more of a passion type of thing.
I needed an escape.
Last year, I took a trip to Flagstaff, where I met a guy named Ryan Elowatt. Ryan and I are both amateur guitarists, and our conversation started off on familiar terrain.
Like, I remember one of my first memories playing guitar was learning a G chord and a C chord from my friend's brother, who we all looked up to, and he taught us some guitar. But I remember learning those first two chords and struggling through them, but just being able to, like, hear those two chords side by side and switch between them was, like, it was just this kind of overwhelming sensation of sound and creating.
I think I've had a similar feeling as a guitar player. And for me, the feeling was very much like, oh, that's all the songs I love. Like, this whole world that, you know, like, music was already very transportive to me, but it also seemed completely mysterious.
Yeah.
And then somebody taught me G, C, and D, and I was like, oh, I could play 80% of those songs.
Yeah, and just the way those chords work together. Yeah, you have this relationship with them already because of listening to music, and it's coming from your hands now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Now, we've all heard the version of this story where that moment, learning those first chords on the guitar, is the inciting incident in a musician's origin story. There are people who spend the rest of their lives chasing the feeling they get in that moment, from the basement of a friend's house all the way to a stadium full of screaming fans. Ryan Elowatt is not that person.
Something about guitar making clicked with me more than guitar playing.
Around the time he started playing the guitar, someone gave Ryan this book about making guitars. It wasn't the best book. The writing was sort of vague and subjective, more of a narrative about this one guy's experience of building guitars than a step-by-step guide. But something about it left an impression on Ryan.
The thing that really blew me away was just seeing that something could be made like that by hand. This kind of like need of, you have to build something to build something. You have to make a jig, and maybe you have to make a tool or set something up to make that jig. And then you're going to use that jig to make a part on the guitar.
Interesting. So if I'm hearing you right, this is going to be a terrible analogy. But it's not like making a soup where you're like, okay, I put water and carrots and onions together and now I have soup. It's like if you had to make the carrot first.
Yeah, yeah. Grow the carrot first.
And so at age 15, Ryan started growing his own carrots. He spent countless hours in the garage with the only sort of helpful book, building his first guitar. He says it took him 3 years.
That one, actually.
Oh, it's that one on the wall, right?
Yeah,
there.
I have it in the office. It doesn't sound great, but it was a real build. I mean, it's a real guitar.
Ryan and I were talking that day in the office of Solstice Guitars, the company Ryan now runs. Solstice builds custom, handmade guitars and electric basses. His customers pay top dollar. The base price for his acoustic guitar, which he calls the Ecliptic, is $6,200. He also makes an electric guitar, he calls that one the Tellurian, and a bass, the Nova. He has display models of all of these instruments mounted on the wall of the office. And hanging next to them is that very first guitar that he built in his parents' garage.
Good to me.
It sounds all right. Made the top too thick. I wouldn't use this kind of wood on a nylon string guitar.
It's now been about 30 years since Ryan built that guitar. These days, he works a little faster, but not much.
I quote customers around 9 to 12 months right now.
Ryan opened Solstice about 5 years ago. His signature product is that acoustic guitar, the Ecliptic. He estimates he's only made about 7 or 8 of them. And when he says that he does a lot of it by hand, He's not kidding. The process starts with slabs of raw wood, some of which comes from right there in Flagstaff.
This is a piece of Sitka spruce, and if you hold one of these plates in the right spot, you can tap it and get some different tones. And if we do that with a different species, you'll hear a totally different sound. This is cedar. And then we could do, here's some ponderosa. And then this is Adirondack spruce, also red spruce, like the old classic martens are Adirondack spruce.
Wow. This, of course, is just the beginning. The wood Ryan taps on gets used for the body of the guitar. But there's also the neck to consider. Then there's the inlay of the fretboard, where Ryan likes to tuck in these subtle crescent shapes that evoke the celestial environment, which, as you may have noticed from his use of names like solstice, ecliptic, and nova, is where Ryan draws a lot of inspiration.
The meaning that I have with that really has to do with kind of our existence on planet Earth. And our entire perception of time is based on this rhythm that our planet experiences as it rotates around the sun. You know, I have a pretty deep thing with music and what it means to be on Earth and as a human and the way we experience time. And it's so easy to, I mean, how can you pay attention to this kind of thing that you're locked into?
As Ryan said all of this, I thought back to that early memory that he and I share, that feeling of strumming G and C chords for the first time, and how maybe the reason that feeling is so transcendent is that in that moment of realizing that the sounds your hands are making are the same sounds that other hands once made, and that those sounds became the songs you listened to transport yourself back to the best moments of your life or to escape the worst ones, what's really happening in those moments is that you're stepping out of time. Not literally, not escaping it, but just noticing it. The fact that you're stuck in it, no matter how much you wish you weren't. That's why Ryan calls his electric guitar the Tellurian, because a Tellurian is a device that measures the movement of the Earth, Moon, and Sun. It's literally a time machine.
Humanity, mm-hmm. connection through music. Wood is a very incredible thing. Like the substance itself is to me like one of the most magical things that I get to work with.
Before I left, I asked Ryan to play me a few chords on the ecliptic.
It's got that real like ring to it.
It's got a kind of some resonance to it that's a little bit unexpected, I hope.
That last thing Ryan said is a little hard to hear, but I wrote it down when he said it, and I've been thinking about it ever since. He said, it's got a resonance that's a little unexpected. Thank you for listening to the show on this Thursday. We are produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. We'll be back here tomorrow morning at 9, and we look forward to talking to you then. Thank you again for listening. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.